This is the Back to Birding podcast, and this is your co-host, Patrick Higgins.
And this is Luke Thompson, and today we are here with Peter Kastner. So welcome, Peter.
Welcome, guys. So it's very nice to be with you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm not even sure where you are, but I'm with you anyway.
We're in Chattanooga right now.
Chattanooga. Right,
very good.
Yeah.
Yep. Have you seen the choo-choo down there?
We have. Yeah. Peter has seen the most species of birds out of anyone in the world as far
in all of history.
In all of history, yeah. Unless there was some birder way back.
Yeah.
I don't know how that would be possible. No. Like
that would be difficult.
Well, like usual, we're going to start out the episode with asking about recent birding. So, Peter, have you done any birding recently in Baltimore International?
I was birding just before I talked to you. In fact, I'm birding right now. I'm watching a house finch and a chipping sparrow on my feeder and a gray squirrel stealing the suet. But I have not been on any trips lately. Just got back from a family trip to northern Michigan.
Nice.
I had a wonderful time up there. The birds are not too different from here.
Yeah.
But for example, around here, the commonest woodpecker is a downy woodpecker and then red belly. Up there, the commonest woodpecker is red-headed, sapsucker, and pileated.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
And downy is like seventh place after a hairy and red-belly up there, too.
I feel like you can see it in Chattanooga, and I'm not sure how it compares to Baltimore, but in Chattanooga, you can see a downy like in a field if it's just scrubby enough, you know? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's really a lot of fun. In fact, there was a family of redheaded woodpeckers that had taken over the bird feeder. Well, when we go up there, we charge the bird feeder and fill it up.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just there for a week. And during that week, almost every day, there were four redheaded woodpeckers, and they would chase away anything that came close to the feeder. It was really quite remarkable. A chickadee would come in, they'd chase it away. A blue jay would come in,
wow.
They'd chase it away. And then the last day, I was watching it, and I thought I had sort of figured out the rhythm. And the woodpecker family flew away. They'd eaten enough and had enough fun chasing people, I guess. And the other birds left, too. I would have thought that once the red-headed woodpeckers had left, that the other birds would say, da-da-da-da-da-da, we now have the feeder to ourselves.
Right.
And they left with the woodpeckers. I couldn't believe it.
That's crazy. That's interesting.
I'm wondering, you know, the red-headed woodpecker is such a dramatic bird. I wonder if that dramatic coloration could possibly be an evolutionary adaptation where other birds follow it and know that the red-headed woodpeckers have some sort of special ability to find food and that the other birds can gain a benefit from being around red-headed woodpeckers.
That's interesting.
Why else would they look like that?
Yeah, I wonder if hummingbirds ever try and get nectar from their heads or not.
That's a good question.
Instead of setting up hummingbird feeders, we just have a red-headed woodpecker tied to a post.
Yep.
That's right. See what happens.
Yeah. Well, it is an interesting topic, I guess. As you come back from these international journeys, do the more common birds from your homeland, hometown, do they get old?
No, absolutely not. And that's one of the wonders of birding. And I don't think that I'm unique in this way, but I love seeing everything except for the squirrel. But we have some salvia planted. We actually have a tiny little what's it called? A deck. We don't have a yard, but
mm-hmm.
we've got a butterfly bush there and a salvia, and the hummingbirds come to the salvia, and it's always a treat to see them. Again, you know, when I was up in the cabin in Michigan, you know, I spent hours watching the woodpeckers and their interactions. No, I never get tired of seeing anything, no matter. I mean, if I see a male house sparrow, I'll look at its throat, because when male house sparrows are fresh in fresh plumage, each of their throat feathers has a little pale fringe on it
really
that covers up the black of the feather underneath of it. And over time, that fringe wears off and the throat of the house sparrow becomes pure black. And this bird, you see this in a lot of things, like red-winged blackbirds and fresh plumage have this sort of dirty look to them, and then over time they get really nice. And it's a way that evolutionarily the birds can get two different plumages out of one molt. So it's a very, very clever way. And I mean, that sort of thing just, I mean, I love birds. I love what they do. I love how they do it. They have so much to teach us, and I'm always learning. I'm always seeing. I mean, the fact that those birds all disappeared when the woodpecker family took off after they harassed them for 30 minutes was mind-blowing. It gets your mind thinking, what's going on here? Why did those birds not take advantage of the absence of the red-headed woodpeckers to chow down? Every time they got near the feeder, they got chased away. It's great. It's great. I love it. I love it. I love adding birds to my list, but I love watching birds. I love the science of birds. I love the behavior. I love their beauty. I love everything about birds.
Well, that's amazing. You really just answered another of our questions, but if there's any more to add, well, I guess I'll go ahead and ask it. Like, what do you think birds and birding can teach us as people?
Gosh, oh, there's so much. I mean, the behavior of birds, the cooperative nature, but also the competition. I mean, I played pickleball in the morning, as most old people do these days. And I was coming off, driving out of the pickleball, and somebody had been feeding the sparrows. It's a senior center. And they were feeding the sparrows or putting cracked corn down on the ground. And as I drove by, a big old female Cooper's hawk flew up. And I said, ooh, it looks like they've got a Cooper's hawk feeder here. So I mean, and you know, there's the interplay of nature and the way that the different species all fit into this fantastic mosaic that is nature and the environment is very, very important for us. And the more that we can understand it, the better we can understand our own place in the environment. And heaven knows that our place in the environment has been so, oh, what's the word? Misused, overdone. I mean, it's just we are the only living creature that sort of has thumbed its nose at Mother Nature and said, "Well, we're going to do it our way and not your way."
Right.
And yeah. I find that very sad.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's very important that the things you do are drawing attention to conservation needs. I think absolutely. So. It's
yeah, great. No, it is wonderful, and one of the fun things about the notoriety of my record is that I've been donating all of the honoraria that I get directly to the American Bird Conservancy to help buy most. They do a lot of creating new reserves and expanding reserves in South America, which is very, very important.
Wow.
Yeah, I've definitely heard some amazing stories about the American Bird Conservancy. I'm thinking, I believe, of one from Ecuador, where this place was going to be bought out and turned, like, destroyed, and then they preserved it. But I'm sure there's stories like that all over from them.
Yeah, and in fact, in 2022, I went down to look at the bird that I had discovered in 1989.
Yep.
And I went to the place where I had discovered it, and it was just a cattle pasture. And I took a selfie of myself with a big frown on my face. I never do selfies with frowns. But anyway, I had to sort of force myself to frown in my selfie at this location with the cattle pasture behind me. And fortunately, in a nearby town, a family had decided to try to feed the Kundinamarca ant pitta, and over a 3-year period they had habituated the birds, and they were coming to a feeder. So I went and saw that, and the local NGO that was working with these people said, "Oh, we need $75,000. Do you have $75,000? You know, you're a rich guy coming from America." I said, "Well, I don't have $75,000, but I know a lot of people back in the States, and I came back and put together a little proposal, and the American Bird Conservancy jumped all over it." And within a year and a half, they had bought the land and created a really impressive reserve around the little finca of this family that was feeding it. So now we have a really significant portion of that endangered highland forest habitat that's now going to be protected forever.
That's phenomenal. Goodness.
And stuff like that, you know, you're preserving, like, obviously a really range-restricted species with that ant peta, but you also end up preserving so much more than that. And I think that's amazing, too.
Like, absolutely. Yeah, no, there are several range-restricted birds that are there. There's an ochre-headed brush finch. There's a blaze-winged parakeet. I mean, they're really, really some very tight endemic and near-endemic species. And there are also things like black and chestnut eagle, Muisca ant peta, which has a very small range. There are lots of birds there that are benefiting from that. You're exactly right, Luke.
And then even just animals, like non-avian animals, they'll end up benefiting from it as well. Just
that's right. As long as they're not gray squirrels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Goodness. Well, I think it might be neat to go through your story relatively chronologically. I think it would be interesting to hear about how you got into birding and maybe even into world listing eventually. And I know you were...
You ask the questions, I'll give you the answers.
All righty. Well, I know you became a diplomat at one point, and that gave you a lot of opportunity to do some world listing. So maybe we can hear about that.
Sure. Since you mentioned chronology, let me go back even a little bit earlier.
All righty.
I started birding because my older brother saw his spark bird when he was 10 and I was only 2 years old.
Wow.
A million flycatcher. So as I grew up, I was always sort of going with my older brother and doing things. I can remember doing breeding bird surveys when I was like 7, 8 years old, 9 years old, doing winter waterfowl surveys. I mean, all kinds of things that we did. Chan Robbins, who is one of the great bird people in the United States, was a mentor of my brother's and to a lesser extent me. And I can remember going out with Chan. One of my very first warblers was a Connecticut warbler that I saw in Ocean City, Maryland.
What? Oh my God.
Like 7 or 8 years old. I can still remember it walking. It was walking along the ground. You know, it was just such a unique way that it was just, and it was right out in the open. It was really crazy. It was in migration along
Connecticut.
Barrier Beach. Yeah. So, I mean, it was in a wooded area, pine forest, where they had a banding station. Mm-hmm. But it was by far the best view. Well, no, I had a good view of one singing up in Minnesota once in the breeding season, but certainly during migration, it was an extraordinary visit.
That's my last.
I saw that before I saw a yellow warbler.
What?
An example. And Chan couldn't believe I hadn't seen a yellow warbler.
That's amazing.
But anyway, so birding for me started very, very young. And when I went to Cornell University, and I was seriously considering being an ornithologist, but someone gave me some really good advice and said, if you become an ornithologist, you'll lose your hobby, because your hobby will then be your business. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have a more balanced, more stimulating life, you might try to do something different. And this guy had been a very successful stockbroker, but he was also a very successful bird photographer. He was one of the first people back in the 50s and 60s to use strobes in hummingbirds.
Okay.
A guy named Crawford Greenwalt, who was the very first, and this guy Brower Hall was one of the very first people to take hummingbird pictures using strobes to freeze the birds, because you couldn't with the film, you couldn't just increase the shutter. You had to find some way of getting enough light in a way that it froze the hummingbirds. And he was one of the, anyway, I digress.
Yeah, no, that's amazing.
Called me. Brower said, do something different. And that was a very good, advice, because what I allowed me to do by joining the Foreign Service, and the reason I joined the Foreign Service was to travel, to live and work around the world. I'd been in the Peace Corps for 2 years directly out of university and lived in a little village in Africa, and loved being in a little village in Africa, saw thousands of birds. I think I added 1,300 birds to my list or something in 2 years. Wow. It was great. Wow. And the only problem with the Peace Corps, I mean, I love being a volunteer. I love dedicating my life to these people in this little village. But as a career, it couldn't pan out, because they don't pay you. So And I like the idea, but I wanted to sort of have a paying job. And the Foreign Service worked out perfectly. To get in the Foreign Service back then, all you have to do is take a test. You take a test, you pass the test, you get in. Pretty much that simple. The year I took it, 25,000 people took the test, and about 200 got in. Wow. So it's very fortunate. I have a real a knack for doing. For guessing multiple choice tests.
Oh, I wish I could
share. I'm not the smartest guy around, but I do really well on multiple choice tests. And I got the absolute lowest passing grade on my Foreign Service test. If I had missed one question, I wouldn't have gotten in.
Wow.
One more question, I should say. So I was very, very fortunate. I have had so many amazingly fortunate things happen to me. So anyway, the Foreign Service was exactly what I'd hoped it would be. It was a fantastic honor to represent my country and represent guys like you. And, when people travel overseas, my specialty in the Foreign Service was consular work. And one of the most important thing that consular officers do is take care of Americans overseas. That means if you were living overseas and you gave birth, the consular officer issues a birth certificate. When you die, the consular officer issues you a death certificate. If you end up in jail, the consular officer will come and visit you. If you end up in the hospital and you don't have anybody there to help you, the consular officer will come and visit you. I even had an American citizen die in a place called the Solomon Islands, and I had to box up his body and ship him off to another country because there was no undertaker in the Solomon Islands. So I actually physically stuff the guy in a coffin that I'd borrowed from the Peace Corps and stuck this guy off and sprayed him down with Lysol and made some fake documents and shipped him off to New Guinea, where I knew there was a proper place for him to be taken care of.
Goodness.
Wow.
Gracious.
That's a story.
A story. That's a story. We could do a whole podcast about that story.
Oh my goodness.
And that's not the worst part of it.
Wow.
I don't know if we want to go into the worst part of it. I'm definitely intrigued.
So anyway, yeah, the Foreign Service was wonderful. Every couple of years you live in a different country. That meant living, learning. I mean, when you move, I'm not sure if you guys have moved much in your life. But as an adult, when you move, you have to do everything. You have to physically move into a new house. You have to figure out where you're going to shop. You have to figure out where you get your haircut. You have to figure out where the kids are going to school. You have to figure, I mean, everything is new. And that the stimulation of that newness was something that I really craved and really, really enjoyed. And along the way, I learned 13 different foreign languages.
Wow.
No, five different ones plus English. So I spoke 13 different languages.
Wow.
And each time I went to some place, if my job required the language, then the State Department would give me the required level of that language. For example, in Spanish, I was able to do any kind of business. I used to do radio interviews in Spanish and television interviews in Spanish. All that, whatever I had to do and negotiate with government officials and things like that. But most in about half of those languages, they were sort of birding languages. So my job, for example, in Papua New Guinea, my job was done in English. But when I was birding up in the highlands, nobody understood English. So I had to learn to speak Tok Pisin, which is their local language.
Oh, wow.
And on the south coast, they spoke a different language called Motu. So I had to learn sort of just enough Motu to get along. A great example, I was in Syria. I was in Syria in 2006 and went to Raqqa, which is now the headquarters of ISIS. I was actually birding in the town of Raqqa.
Wow.
And by myself, I'd flown up from Cairo, arrived after it's like 9 o'clock at night, rented a car, drove overnight up through the desert. So I'm at Raqqa and I'm going to a place looking for my 8,000th bird. And I stopped at a little store because I was going off on a track into the desert by myself. And I said, well, I better buy some extra water just in case we break down or something. I don't want to die. So I go in, there's this old man. He only speaks Arabic. So I greet him in Arabic and I ask him for some cold water. And he looks at me and he goes, "Are you American?" in Arabic. And I say, "Yes, I'm an American." And he starts pounding his fist and says, "George Bush is no good. George Bush is no good." Smash, smash. It's really, it's just incredible anger. So I threw up my hands. And I said, "Hey, I'm an American, but I'm not George Bush." And this big smile came on his face. Everything was fine. So he went off and got me some very cold water and everything was fine. But you know, it doesn't take much to learn, you know, just some very simple communications in a language. Mm. And the time that I put into learning Arabic, sort of my bird watching Arabic, really paid off because, you know, I was able to make a connection with this guy and really impress him that you know, Americans are not necessarily what their presidents are. Right. And that you don't have to judge us in the same way.
That's it also definitely breaks down a barrier of respect whenever.
For sure.
It is very true. Very true. And I had a couple of times. One of them was in Afghanistan, where I spent a year. I went and talked to a senior general who was in charge of security in northern Afghanistan. And my Dari was not very good, but it was, you know, sort of bird watching Dari. It should have been better, but wasn't. But I was able to explain myself, introduce myself, tell me where I'd come from, my family, sort of just basic stuff. And he did the same thing in English. And it turned out that his level of English and my level of Dari were almost exactly the same. And it just, you know, the mutual respect, as you said, Patrick, the mutual respect was just instantaneous. And we developed a really close working relationship, although, you know, all of our normal business was done through interpreters. But just that initial effort that we both made was really magical.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
You know,
we're not talking about birds.
That's all good. I did an interview with Ken Behrens and we talked about birds for about 2 minutes. So
a very interesting guy.
Whenever we get off topic, what we like to say here on the Back to Birding podcast is, let's get back to birding.
Back to birding. Okay.
But I will say this isn't back to birding. Sorry, Patrick. But it sounds like a job like that and just the travel just forces you to be incredibly adaptable. Could you speak some on that, maybe?
Yeah. No, that's that. And again, it took a year and a half to get into the Foreign Service. There's a lot of paperwork and security clearances and medical clearances and all kinds of stuff. And as I was waiting, I got a job working in downtown Baltimore. And one day I was commuting down the Jones Falls Expressway, Route 83. And I got about 3/4 of the way to work. And I woke up and I said, "Gosh, here I am just on cruise control. I mean, I'm not thinking, I'm just, you know, driving to work every day the same place." And I suddenly realized just how important that stimulation is to me. And everybody's different, right? A lot of people I know like the idea of stability. They like coming back to the same house. They like seeing the same friends. But the way my brain is my personality is wired, I thrive on new places and new things and new challenges. So for me, it was perfect. It really was.
Yeah.
But it might not be perfect for somebody else.
Well, I guess we can get back to birding now.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess we can get into the world listing then. I mean, you mentioned briefly like hitting 8,000 birds in 2006, or at least aiming for it then.
I did get the bird, CC Partridge.
Nice.
Nice.
Nice. So, I mean, when did you really commit yourself to these, you know, massive quantities of species, or was it kind of a casual thing?
Committing myself to the massive number of birds. Well, let me put it this way. I did my first international trip when I was 10.
Wow.
Wow. My mentor brother Hank, who is 8 years older, he was 18 at the time, he took me to Grand Bahama Island. We were down visiting Florida, and Fort Lauderdale. We flew out to Grand Bahama for the day. 4 years later, when I was 14, my little brother and I did an overnight trip to Nassau, Bahamas, birding. Now, can you imagine two 14-year-old kids, or no, a 14 and a 12-year-old kid hopping on a plane, no credit cards, no passport, flying to another country? We did very well. We cleaned up all the endemics that we needed to see.
Nice.
That's crazy.
We had nothing. It was crazy. We got there. We got to the airport, and if you've been on in Nassau, New Providence Island, the airport is on the west side of the island, and the town is on the northeast side. We didn't know. We had no idea. We get off at the airport, and we start walking into town. And it's the middle of the day. We got a little tiny suitcase that my grandmother must have lent us with all our stuff in it. And we're walking along, and I remember vividly that we had just gone through some mangroves, and I just got my lifer thick-billed vireo.
Wow, good bird.
And this guy drives up in this big convertible car. So like this. And this is what I was 14, so that would have been 53, have been 67 or 68, 1968. So this guy has this like 1950s big old giant car. And he drives up and says, "What are you guys doing?" He said, "Oh, we're walking into Nassau." And he says, "It's 23 miles and it's the middle of the day." Of course, we didn't have any water or anything. So he gave us a ride in, and apparently, my little brother remembers this better than I, my Tom. Apparently, he set us up and found us a place to stay, a hotel, and all this stuff. We had no idea what the hell we were doing. We were just going bird watching in Nassau, and my grandmother let us do it. She paid for the ticket and gave us some money for hotel and stuff. But
Crazy.
it was crazy, absolutely crazy.
Wow.
It does seem like that childlike wonder has not left you, even after these decades.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I know a lot of people who like are pretty into listing and then they lose that entire wonder of birds, but I really love how intense you love birds still after seeing 10,000 species. It's incredible.
Yeah, no, each one is great, and I'm looking forward to adding to the list. I've taken a little bit of a hiatus. We had planned to move into a new house. We spent 2 years building a new house. And just after the house was built, we got this, what's called the certificate of occupancy. We decided to sell it because we didn't want to commit ourselves financially and otherwise to developing this new house, and rather wanted to keep the money so we could travel. So we're gonna continue traveling. But that process is sort of used up the last 3 or 4 months, pretty much. But we're planning a trip next month, mostly scuba diving down to the ABC Islands, Aruba, Bonaire, and Curaçao, a place I've never been. And my main, there are no, I don't think there are any potential lifers there, but there are three eBird countries and territories down there. I'm at 190. I'm trying to get up to 200 eBird countries and territories. So that's my, apart from the fact that there's great scuba diving, and one of the things that I do with my wife, Kimberly, who's been a real trooper all these years, is enjoy going scuba diving together. And so we're looking at different places where we can do scuba diving and pick up a few birds along the way.
Awesome. Do you list other species like fish? Like
Yes, I do. I started at during the COVID lockdown, and I use iNaturalist for everything except for birds. And I've got around 3,200 species in iNaturalist right now.
Wow, that's
Goodness.
amazing.
So yeah, no, and it's interesting. We were just in Iceland. We went to Iceland for our anniversary. I was invited to give a talk at the Global Bird Fair in the UK, which was a real wonderful honor, and it turned out really well. It was a great event, a great experience. On our way, we stopped off in Iceland. There's a super cheapo, it's called Play Airways, and they give you a free stopover in Iceland. We stopped there for a couple nights, and on our anniversary day, the day of our anniversary, we did extreme whale watching. Extreme whale watching is done in a little rubber boat out in the Arctic Ocean. The water is 40 degrees.
Oh my.
And they put you in one of these giant survival suits with rubber, with goggles and everything. And you're out in this boat, and the boat's bouncing up and down. You get sprayed. They don't even have seats. You have to stand up and hold on to a, I don't know, it's a metal bar or something as you're bouncing over the. It was absolutely one of the most fun things we've ever done. Before we even got near the whales, I turned to Kimberly and said, "Kimberly, this is definitely worth it. Even if we don't see any whales, this is like the most fun ever." We did extreme whale watching, but the point of this talk, the point of that story is not the whale watching, but I had been to Iceland four times and I'd always been there looking for birds. There are very few birds in Iceland. And I don't think I've never seen a lifer bird in Iceland because all of them are, they're just, it's not a good place for lifers, but it's a fun place. Yeah. But as we were driving, instead of looking for rare birds or not rare, but birds that are just very infrequent, very low density, I'm looking for plants. And it turns out in this Arctic tundra, there are dozens and dozens of tiny little plants. So it gave me a whole nother perspective on nature. You know, as you're, I mean, I still saw all the birds I saw, but there are very few birds there. And between the birds, I was looking at plants. And this is sort of the same thing. If I'm in a place where there are no potential lifers, or, you know, I've got an extra day somewhere, very often I will go around and see if I can add new plants or insects or mammals or herps or whatever it is to my iNaturalist list. So it's a fun dimension. Phoebe Snetsinger, the very famous American birder, started ticking butterfly fish before she died.
Really?
I have a goal of getting to 100 butterfly fish in her honor. I'm at about 80 now.
Are there any expected where you're going?
No. There's one possible. Butterfly fish are kind of weird. Okay. Most butterfly fish are very easy to see. They're in shallow water. They're very pretty. They're very distinctive. But there's about 20 species of butterfly fish in the world that are really deep. And they like live 60 to 100 meters deep. And we don't, recreational divers normally don't go down that deep. So every once in a while, one of these really deep fishes will come up and you can see it. I saw one in Pemba, the Pemba Straits, which is off of eastern Tanzania. And I asked the dive instructor, I said, "You don't have any of this Indian butterfly fish around?" He says, "Yes, I can show you one." So we went down, we were like 40 meters deep, really low. And we went into a cave and this fish was living on the ceiling of the cave upside down. In this cave, he must have thought he was much deeper than he was. And I was able to see it. I was so excited. I was dancing a jig down.
Underwater.
Wow, that's amazing.
That was really neat.
That's crazy. Goodness. Upside down in a cave. Wow.
Yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful fish. But the main thing is just, and it's much like birds, it's its rarity. I mean, the fact that so very few people ever see it because it does live so deep.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well,
get back to birding. We're off of birding.
Yeah, there you go. So I listened to you briefly in a couple other podcasts, and I heard that you hit 9,000 in 2016, I believe. Maybe 18.
Maybe 18.
18. And then using that, when did you, I guess, realize that 10,000 was possible? And then in conjunction, when did you kind of understand that you were going to be the one to get it?
Yeah, that was, well, the one to get it, I don't know. And it's sort of interesting. I told people as I was trying to get to 10,000 that it's sort of like a race at night where you can't see the trail and you can't see the other competitors because you don't know. I mean, and to this day, it is not inconceivable that somebody beat me to 10,000 and just never told anybody about it.
Yeah.
No, a lot of birders just do it for themselves. So You know, I got 10,000 for me. I didn't get 10,000 because I was trying to beat anybody.
Right.
It was really, for me, it was trying to, I mean, I love round numbers, and there's no rounder number in birds than 10,000. And you know, as it turned out, somebody did almost beat me and claimed to have beat me on the very same day that I saw 10,000, which is just an extraordinary coincidence. And because of that, the sort of the internet blew up, and both of our lists were scrutinized very, very heavily because of that.
Yeah, we were right there through all that drama.
Yeah.
we were watching third party.
I was in a one-star hotel in southeastern Mindanao all by myself in this dump in the middle of nowhere.
Goodness.
What
gracious.
Were you looking for out there?
I got my 10,000th bird there.
Orange-tufted spider hunter.
Orange-tufted spider hunter. Yeah. There's some great birds there that the orange-tufted spider hunter is not very high on anybody's list to go to Mindanao. It's an endemic in Mindanao. It's been recently split, but there's some really good birds there. There's a pitta. It's not completely endemic to Mindanao, but it's easy to get there. There's a Mindanao wattled broadbill, which is a fabulous bird. There's some really, really good stuff there.
Wow. Did you have a bird that you were maybe hoping would be your 10,000th?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I assume that you all have seen the article that I wrote for Birding Magazine, where I had set up a plan, and my goal was to get the tufted puffin, which I still haven't seen.
Really?
It's a lower 48 bird that, I mean, it's a pretty easy bird to get if you put your mind to it. And my idea was to do it as a sort of an ABC fundraiser, go with family and friends, and you know, make a real party out of it. And unfortunately, this guy Jason Mann came along, and I had to change my plans and fly out to East Asia a couple of times very, very quickly and get the bird. And it's, you know, my wife and my brother Hank were the two people that insisted that I go, because I, you know, again, I to me the competition wasn't that important. And when I heard Jason Mann was going to do it, I sort of said, okay, you know, he's going to do it. And my wife said, you've got to be kidding. You've done all your life. You've been looking for this, and you're not going to let this guy beat you. And, you know, Hank was so supportive. He said he'd pay for my air ticket to fly out to get to 10,000. And so I, you know, I said, okay, yeah, sure. You know, I'll go do it. And again, I love the competition, but for me, the birds are more important than the competition. But it turns out that my wife and brother were dead right, because if I hadn't gotten that bird on the February 9th, 12 hours after Jason Mann posted his thing, it may have ended very differently.
Yeah. Yeah.
There may not be the scrutiny, as it turned out. So very happy.
You have a follow-up goal now that you've achieved such an incredible one. Maybe it has something to do with that tufted puffin, but
well, I certainly would like to see a tufted puffin at some point. I was supposed to go on a cruise with Kimberly, my wife, to Eastern Siberia, and unfortunately, when the Russians invaded Ukraine, the trip to Eastern Siberia was canceled. So I would have had Tuff and Puffet on my list for, you know, some time before. I guess my short-term goal is to help a friend. And I just learned in the last 2 weeks or so, I guess, that a guy named Joe Trezza, who is the author of the article that was published in the New York Times about my record, which ended up on the front page, which is quite remarkable. Joe Trezza has just gotten a contract to write a book called A Big Life. And it's going to be about the record and also about other sort of world listers. And that is due out in 2026. So my short-term goal is to make sure that when that book is published, that I'm still number one, so that I'm not introduced as a former number one birder.
Right. Yeah. I guess along the lines of keeping written records, have you journaled your birds over all these years? What has your field data collection kind of looked like?
Yeah, I was also wondering that, seeing some old...
I was afraid you might ask that question. That is one of my biggest failings. Mm. And I do not have journals. I have a lot of information sort of scattered around, you know, trip lists, communications with people. You know, back in the old days, back, you know, in the 70s and 80s, when I was traveling around the world starting this whole business, you know, I wanted to go to Hispaniola and try for the Lascelles thrush in Haiti, which is just crazy. But anyway, so I wrote a letter to James Bond, the ornithologist in Philadelphia, and he wrote me a really nice letter back about how to see the Lascelles thrush in Haiti. I still kept it because it was actually on James Bond letterhead. I mean, it's really quite nice.
That's awesome.
And I was several years after that, I was in the Dominican Republic, and he gave me some hints on finding the double-striped thickney in the eastern part of Dominican Republic, which I dipped, unfortunately. It was one of the most awful experiences I've ever had. But that's another podcast. You can have a whole podcast of terrible experiences.
Yeah, sounds like it. I guess when you travel that much, you rack them up.
Yeah.
But you rack up the amazing experiences as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I've had, and again, I've just been so blessed with incredibly good luck. I've been shipwrecked in the Amazon.
Wow.
The Amazon's a funny place. It's very wide. It's like 30 or 40 miles wide, but 99% of it is very shallow. Mm-hmm. And you know, during the rainy season, it floods, the Varzea forest floods, and it gets very, very wide. And then dry season, it gets much, much smaller, but still like 10 miles wide. Well, in the center, there's a shipping channel that's like 100 feet deep. And that's the way you get these big boats going up to like Leticia and these different places. Mm-hmm. But it's a very narrow channel. We were in the channel one night and we ran into one of these giant boats, and it poked a hole right in our boat and we started sinking. And the leader out there, I was with a guy named Steve Hilty. He's a very, very famous guy. Steve had taken the launch from the boat, which would have been our rescue vessel. He had taken the launch up to Leticia to get the hotel all sorted out. And left me in charge.
Oh, wow.
And the crew of the boat all spoke Portuguese, and I didn't speak Portuguese at that time. In fact, my Spanish was horrible. So I'm in charge. The boat is sinking. I didn't realize anything about the physiography of the river. I didn't know how deep it was or anything. All I know is this giant ship just crashed into us in the middle of the night. So they're obviously it's very deep because there's a giant ship just ran us over. The giant ship just kept on going downstream. They never stopped to check on us.
Wow.
We didn't have any way of getting off of the sinking ship. But when it hit us at an angle. We went off to the side. And when by the time we sank to the bottom of the river, we were in that shallow part of the river outside of the shipping channel. And the boat sank, ended up with a few inches of freeboard or whatever. The very top of the boat was still out of the water. So as the boat is going down, we're all grabbing our stuff and going up and standing on the roof of the boat. So we're all standing on the roof of the boat. The boat is sitting on the bottom of the river, and the river dolphins are coming up. You could hear them going, meow, 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 meow.
Wow.
It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. We're just sitting there in the middle of the river. And again, the other boat's gone, and we're just sitting there, you know, probably 10 miles from land. And after a while, Steve Hilty realized that we were late, and he got the police out, and they came looking for us and found us sitting on top of the boat in the middle of the Amazon River in the middle of the night.
I'm sure that was the last time you were trusted as a captain.
Your first time as a captain?
No, I was just in charge of the clients. I wasn't in charge of the boat. But it was interesting, neither the boat that hit us nor our boat had any running lights or any lights at all. Because I can remember one of the Portuguese guys, we were birding along the border of Brazil. One of the Portuguese guys got out a flashlight when he saw this giant boat coming and starts flashing the flashlight at this great big ship that ran us over. It was not fun.
That is a story. Not many people can say they've been shipwrecked in the Amazon.
No. But the amazing thing is that if we had gone down in the shipping channel, we would have been floating off to the Atlantic Ocean and we'd all been dead.
Wow. And all it took was just being hit at that right angle.
And the fact that we went off to the side and the shipping channel, as it turns out, you can Google it, is very deep, but it's very narrow. And fortune and it's sort of a double-edged sword. It was because it was narrow, we had the collision because the ships are all in this narrow part of the river. You have a 10-mile river. How do you have a collision in this tiny little area? Because the shipping channel is narrow. But also it saved us because the shipping channel is narrow. We were able to get out of it by the time we actually sunk to the bottom.
Yeah. Wow, that sounds intense.
It was and until we actually hit the bottom, it was very intense because I'm sort of going through my mind how I'm going to save the lives of these eight bird watchers.
What does go through your mind in a moment like that? Like what is that experience like?
Yeah, it I am by nature a problem solver. And I did a personality test. It's something called Myers-Briggs personality test. And they have like 64 different personalities. And my personality is problem solver. I love problems. I love figuring out things. I love when the shit hits a fan and I'm trying to figure out how to make everything be okay. And it's by just some remarkable coincidence, that's the thing that I'm the best at.
Well, I think that leads into a funny question, but what has been the hardest bird to see? And not
Oh yeah.
necessarily in terms of rarity, but just actually
Wait,
making.
Kimberly, Kimberly, come say hi to Patrick and Luke.
Hi.
We've been talking about Kimberly.
It's nice to meet you.
Hi.
Sort of the hardest physical bird. Gosh, I guess it was probably the blue-bearded helmet crest.
I literally was just looking into that, and I was going to ask you about how you got that bird.
Yeah, that's probably, but it was a long, steep hike, but as far as birds go, I was with guides that knew where we were going and everything was all set up. We went and stayed, made a little camp at this indigenous village halfway up. So it was really, there was no adventure in it. It was just a question of we started about a maybe 5,000 feet elevation and we went to 14,000 feet in 2 days. So it was not an easy walk, especially for somebody in their 60s, but there was a guy up there in street shoes. I was up there, some guy from France or something was walking along in street shoes, and he'd done this thing with no hiking boots or anything. So, but yes, I think in terms of the amount of energy expended for a couple of birds up there, I ended up with three lifers. But yeah, that was probably the most difficult walk, but it was a really easy bird.
What do you think the most adventurous bird, or like you had to go through the most like adventures or maybe troubles to get to, was aside from, say, the physical part?
Yeah, there's one, and it's somewhat ironic. When I was in college, I was a teaching assistant at Cornell in the ornithology course. So I was helping the professor. And one of the things that we did in that course is we taught the students about all the bird families. Back then there were 159, I think. And so we got all the different families out of the collection, and they had to learn the characteristics of all the families of birds as part of the ornithology course. And I decided at that point, rather than trying to compete with people that had a lot of money and a lot of time, which I had neither of, for sort of the bird list, that I would try to be the first person to see all the bird families of the world. Mm-hmm. And so I made that goal back in, I guess it would have been 1976 when I graduated. And my first, after I went 76 to 78, I was in the Peace Corps, and I came back, took a year and a half to get in the Foreign Service. So my first State Department job starts in 1980. They send me to New Delhi, India. And in New Delhi, there are basically three families. You need the pittas, you need the leaf birds, and you need the Ibidorhynchidae, the ibisbill. Now, back then, the ibisbill was very, very poorly known. Almost nobody had any idea. They knew it bred up in the Tibetan plateau, and they had no idea where it wintered. So I have to get to the Tibetan plateau somehow. Well, in the year that I was born, 1953, there was a book published called The Breeding Birds of Kashmir. And in that book, they talk about the ibisbill breeding in the southeastern part of Kashmir in the Wardwan Valley. So I figured this is the only thing I know about the ibisbill, so I'll go to the Wardwan Valley and see if I can find it. And the Wardwan Valley is in southeastern Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, they actually have a photograph of the Wardwan River. And it says, this is the breeding habitat of the ibisbill. There's no ibisbill in the picture, but it's a photograph it's something called shingle, which is a weird name. And shingle river are rocks that are, I don't know, 4 to 6 inches in diameter. They're all very, very similar. They're sort of these round river rocks. And the ibisbill has a round beak that goes right around these 4-inch diameter rocks. It's really neat. So anyway, so they had this picture of the habitat. So guess it was Labor Day, 1982. So Friday night, I fly up to Srinagar, Kashmir, and get a ride down to a forest hut down in southeastern part of Kashmir. So I'm down in the main valley of Kashmir, which is probably 5,000 feet elevation. So the next morning, I get up and I walk almost straight up a mountain up to a 12,000 foot pass. So I go up 7,000 feet straight up and then get to the top. And the name of that pass is called the Margon Pass, or the Pass of Death, because a few years before that, some nomadic people that spend the summers in the high valleys and then come down to the low valley in the winter, they came through in September and an early snowstorm caught them and killed a whole bunch of people. So they call it the Pass of Death now. So anyway, so I get up to the Pass of Death, and it's a pretty, you know, I'm young back then. This is back in the 80s. I'm 30 years old, so I can climb up really, you know, no problem. So I get up to the Margon Pass, and then it's another 20, 25 miles down to the river. So hike, get down finally at the end of the day, and it's like, I don't know, 5 o'clock in the afternoon or something. It's starting to get a little dusky, and I walk down to the river, and I'm on a little rise, and I suddenly realize that I am at the exact spot where that photograph in the book had been taken.
That's crazy.
No. I look at it's just the exact perspective and everything. And I have a somewhat photographic memory. And it just like said, wow, this is where that photo was taken. And I look down and there's an ibisbill on the side.
Oh my word. That's
freaking ibisbill on the side of it.
Can you describe that bird for those who might not know it super well? It's one of
them. It's a large shorebird. It's sort of like a Wimbrel meets Gucci. It is really classic sort of gray and black and white colors.
Uh-huh.
Has a blood red curved beak.
Wow.
It's a very, very handsome bird. But it has this beautiful sort of gray and black and white. It just reminds me a lot of the sort of the Gucci, this really classic style of you know, understated but very formal, very, very pretty. So anyway, it's a great bird, and As soon as I get there, I see it. My mind just goes nuts because I mean, all this work, and it really, nobody had ever been up there. These guys had seen the bird. The bird book was published in the early 50s, so they'd probably been up there 40 or 30 or maybe 50 years earlier and found this bird. So I'm going on Jen that's maybe 40, 50 years old. So
Goodness.
I'm really taking a bit of a chance on this. And to have it just sitting there exactly where I showed up was just
That's
extraordinary.
incredible.
Extraordinary.
Wow.
Then I had to walk back because I had to be back at work. And the first part of the trip was not too bad. I was at 20, it's sort of going up and up and up and up and up and up. But my legs were so tired, even being young and in fit and all that. I had at some points it was so steep coming back down the hill that I actually walked backwards because my legs ached so much
Oh my word.
going down frontwards. So I actually walked backwards down this steep mountain slope because my legs were just burning up.
I'm sure it was worth it.
Oh, it was definitely worth it. And I had to get back in time because I couldn't go down the mountain at night. I had to get back in time to be able to get back to the forest rest house to sleep. Anyway, it was a great trip. And I have lots of photographs of it. And one of the interesting things is there's a group of people called Jugars, which speak their own language, but it's related to a language called Punjabi, which I spoke because one of the things I did in the embassy was do visa interviews. And I did a lot of visa interviews in Punjabi. So these guys, these crazy nomadic herders that were up in the high valleys and were coming down the pass as I was going up, I was passing them and I was able to speak, not to discuss politics or anything, but just to give them general greetings and stuff. And they were just amazed that this white guy out in the middle of nowhere speaking their language to them. It was really a lot of
That's
fun.
awesome. I love to hear
Gosh.
it. Well, maybe one of our last questions since we're about an hour in, but I was wondering if you have any birds or like locations in the world that stand out to you as like top or favorite that you've been to.
Colombia has got to be my favorite birding destination. It used to be the what's called the old Buenaventura Road, which back in the day, back in the 80s, was one of the great spots of birding in the world between Cali and Buenaventura. But now so many places in the Andes and especially in Colombia and Ecuador are set up with hummingbird feeders and hummingbird gardens, ant pittas that are coming to feeders, so that the ecotourism development in that part of the world is very, very impressive. And since the bird that's named after me lives in Colombia, I have to have a special link to that. And also my oldest daughter was born in Bogota, so I just it's got to be Colombia. It's got to be
Yeah,
Colombia.
for
Wow.
sure. I'm probably going to be headed that way in 4 months, so
Super, super. Where are you
glad to
going?
hear. I don't know. I have to I'm still deciding between Peru and Colombia, and then I've got to plan it all
Go to Colombia.
out.
Peru is great. Colombia is greater.
But well, maybe that'll be the deciding factor there.
And you can always, I mean, I'm guessing that you will have time in your life that you could probably go to both of them at some point.
Oh, for sure. I'm hoping so. Yeah. I'm spent 2 months in Panama and now I'm just in love with the international travel. So
It does get under your skin, no doubt.
yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I'm also interested. So you said you were working in Papua New Guinea, was correct?
Yes.
So I've heard a lot about the birding there, and it's, some of the birds there are some of the most fantastic in the world. What was that like? Like both from a human standpoint and from a birds and wildlife standpoint.
I think I've mentioned a couple of times the extraordinarily good luck that I've had in my life. And the amazing thing that happened to me in Papua New Guinea is a guy named Brian Finch. Brian Finch right now lives in Kenya, but he had lived in Papua New Guinea for several years. He is one of the very best field birders I've ever met in my life. And I arrived in Papua New Guinea, and Brian Finch is there. And we had so many adventures. And when I first got there, I didn't look at any birds. I think I arrived on a Tuesday or something. And Brian and I went out on that weekend. And because I didn't look at any, you know, just didn't see anything. If a starling flew by, I didn't have any care to identify what species of starling it was. We went out, I saw 104 lifers on my first day of birding in Papua New Guinea. Then on the second day, I added another 50 lifers. So I had over 150 lifers in 2 days birding in Papua New Guinea. But we had a wonderful time, and I owe so much to Brian. He is a great guy and a truly amazing field birder. He was able to, he didn't use a tape recorder, but he would imitate.
Really?
He could imitate about 50 species of really hard to see birds. And he would start whistling away. Next thing you know, some parrot or some fantail or whatever would just pop right up. Mm-hmm. I had a tape recorder, but he was just an amazing guy and has done a lot in Kenya, increasing the knowledge of the avifauna there. And he discovered a new species of a gamma lizard. And just a really, really super guy. And you know, so much of the joy that I got living there was because of Brian. And also there were a lot of young sort of single people there. So we had a really good social situation. One of them is a guy named Nigel Hartley, who's still a good friend that lives in Australia now. He's a very good birder. And Nigel and Brian and I went out and we just had a great time. We just really had a great time. The birds are amazing. It can be very difficult birding because the birds are hunted.
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
Mercilessly. So and that's only getting worse, unfortunately. But it's a great place. There are extraordinary birds. I have some amazing stories. I was taken out birding. I saw my lifer dwarf cassowary in the presence of a cannibal that actually had a human skull hanging from his neck.
What?
It's another podcast.
Whoa.
That's the reason we want to interview you, is for those stories.
Holy crap.
Goodness.
That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah, I just returned from Kenya last week. I was there for 10 days. That was my first continent I've been to other than North America, and the culture shock was definitely real. It was very, you know, we have our westernized mindsets, but I'm sure you are very well seasoned in the cultures of the world. And you mentioned multiple times just posting up in little villages or just interacting with local people. And that's really remarkable and admirable that you take the time to interact with the locals. And I know that you're well esteemed for your shout outs to local guides for a lot of the birds that you do get. So I just want to, I guess, thank that and just draw attention to it. But
yeah, you're very kind. And one of the things that has become more and more obvious to me is that birding is a team sport. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have, you know, I'd mentioned James Bond back in the 1970s. You know, I have gotten assistance from so many people in so many different ways. You know, my brother teaching me so much when I was a child and helping me in so many ways even now. So yeah, no, it's if you don't understand, I sort of going back to what we were talking about before about man's place in nature. Mm-hmm. If you don't understand your own place in nature and the, you know, having gratitude for, you know, my wife, who has the patience of Job and has only once told me that I could not go bird watching, which is another story. you know, I am so blessed and so thankful every day for the people that helped me, the opportunities that I've had for the honor of working for the government and living in all these wild and crazy places. I'm a very full guy.
Yeah, well, amazing.
Yeah, you have some phenomenal accomplishments under that belt. You're not done yet, I'm sure.
Yeah.
No, definitely not done yet.
Yeah. That's great.
Back to birding.
Back to birding. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I guess this is a little bit of a more basic question, but it's something that I think every birder is asked many times in their life. But do you have a favorite bird?
Is it the ampit?
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Valeria Casonrai.
Yeah.
Has to be my favorite
I
bird.
Guess, goodness.
You've got an easy setup for that, I guess.
Yes. No, that there, you know, some people have to think about that, but there, that one's too easy.
For all of us that don't have a bird named after us, it's a little tough.
Oh, man.
Goodness. Well, yeah, I think, you know, we could go ahead and wrap it up here, but do you have anything you want to draw light to or bring attention to? I know you're
Sure.
Working for Rock Jumper, and you say that you're working with someone producing a book here soon. So
The book is going to be some time before it gets written and published, but do look out for it. The author is Joe Trezza, and I'm sure it will be all over the airwaves once it does get published. But I'm really looking forward to that, and I've been trying to share some of my crazier stories with Joe. Make the book interesting. But I guess my message is just one of gratitude and the importance of international bird tourism as a means of conservation, that we have an opportunity, and I have quite frankly a privilege of being able to travel and being able to influence people, to being able to create this this reserve for the Cundinamarca Antpitter by connecting people together. It wasn't my doing, but I was able to be a catalyst to bring the ABC and the Fundación Caminat together. So yeah, no, it's a wonderful world we live in, and we need to take care of it. That means taking care of all parts of it, including each other. And I certainly wish you guys all the success in the world in your podcast and in your birding. And look forward to doing another interview with you in 10 or 15 years.
Absolutely.
All right.
Yep.
Well, it's great to have you on. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you guys very much. Take care.